Hello.
Hey, it's Andy. How are you?
Andy. Good. How are you doing?
I'm not too bad. It's nice to meet your voice, man.
You too. All the way from New York.
Yep. Upstate New York, too, not the city.
What's that?
Upstate New York, too, not the city.
Oh, yeah, I realize. I love that part of the world.
And I'm actually probably the age you were when you were in Nome, so.
I was 27 or so. I was late, a little bit late.
Nine next August, so, yeah. All right, so.
So, well, dude, this is the first interview I've ever done post-band.
Are you seriously?
100% serious.
I feel honored. You guys were such a blip, but you guys were great. I mean, well, first of all, how have you been these days, and what are you up to these days?
I've been good. I've been, good. Well, you know, what, do you want me to launch into the story, or...
Yeah, tell me about the beginnings when you decided you wanted to be a guitar player in a band. And all that.
That's when I was about 13.
Oh, wow.
When I, me and my buddies were into Lynyrd Skynyrd.
Nice.
And the Triple Guitar Attack, you know, so we found this great guitar teacher. Because I grew up in Pennsylvania, so.
Oh, what part?
Outside Philadelphia, Newtown Square, more or less.
Okay, I'm originally from York, Pennsylvania.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah, I know that part of the world pretty well.
Yeah. Are you familiar with that area?
Yeah, York, and my wife's folks live in Mechanicsburg.
Oh, wow, okay. So, yeah.
Carlisle area, yeah.
Yeah, I grew up in a small town specifically on the outskirts called Spring Grove.
Wow.
Dad works at the paper company there.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, so we started playing guitar because of actually the Allman Brothers song One Way Out.
Oh, wow, that's a great one.
Because it has a lot of, what we focused on was picking out different parts, right? And then we would each pretend to be one part. And we would mess around with these tennis rackets, you know, and then we were like, wait a second, we could actually learn to play guitars.
Instead of pretending.
So
my air guitar was on an aluminum baseball bat to Kiss at age.
Totally. Everybody has that first thing where they're like this object and you're just miming and then it strikes you like, wait.
Yeah, I started at 9 years old on bass and moved up to lead guitar myself. So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So with this Southern rock thing was all guitars for us. So, like, we learned and all had this teacher. And so that's how it all began for me in guitar, and I've been playing the guitar ever since, you know.
What other influences did you have then?
Say that again?
What other early influences did you have?
Well, I mean, let's see. It was strictly the Southern rock thing, and then we moved to Montana.
Ooh.
Which was pretty harsh, you can imagine, and
I got
into kind of the punk rock, the Sex Pistols and AC/DC, and you know, but prior to that, I should go back. There was definitely Kiss and Boston, and
it's me because I interviewed Eric Birdieshaw, and there's enough material there to write a book, so I'm still in the process of transcribing and editing it down.
Wow.
Everybody in the grunge scene, it's funny, that I've talked to is influenced by a lot of, like, 60s stuff, a lot of early hard rock and stuff. And, you know, sometimes, like, you know, it's just interesting how you guys all kind of had the same kind of influences within that scene.
Yeah. Well, it was, you know, my formative years weren't in Seattle, which is something that could be interesting, too. Like, nobody in the grunge scene talks about Southern rock, probably.
Yeah, you're the first one that's mentioned Southern rock, for sure.
Oh, yeah. It was all about that.
I was into the Beatles, and Gary Lee Conner was into, you know, the psychedelic stuff. So,
yeah.
Like,
well, Beatles, I mean, the Beatles is always there because my dad was a Beatles guy. So,
my dad but my mom.
I knew about the Beatles, but as a guitar player, the Beatles weren't really my thing. It was it was lead guitar playing and blues, you know.
Did you have, what were your first bands? What were they like? And what did you call bands?
Well, my first band was like junior high and high school. It was called Northwind.
Nice.
We didn't want to use the word South because it was too, we weren't Southern, and we were like, we can't say South because we're not from the South, so we got to come up with something.
Yeah, you don't want to piss off the Southerners.
We didn't want to be posers, you know, or pretend, so.
Yeah, exactly.
So Northwind was, you know, that band, and we played the prom and the dances and stuff, and that was the late 70s. And then, as I say, I moved to Montana in 1980 and didn't play guitar. I quit playing.
Really? Was there a reason?
I quit playing in high school because in Montana there was no, like, scene to get into.
Oh, okay, gotcha. So it was
right.
Like,
so I abandoned it largely. Sold my SG. I had like a, I don't know if you've had this experience yet, but I've had so many guitars where I'm like, God, I wish I had that guitar still.
Yeah, too. I had to sell a brand new black on black Dean Flying V to pay my rent one time.
Oh no!
Like I literally had it for 2 days. I didn't even get to plug it in, and like, yeah. I lost my job at the time and had a family to support, so.
Ah, dude.
Yeah.
Well, my guitar I sold in Montana was a 69 SG.
Oh, buddy.
With the Bigsby whammy and everything. And,
ooh.
And I had traded, for that, I had traded a Dan Armstrong, one of those clear plexiglass guitars.
Oh, yeah?
Back in Pennsylvania, I traded for the SG, and. Anyways, those are two guitars I wish I still had. But in Montana, I sold the SG and just got out of it, and I dedicated myself to playing soccer in high school.
Ah, gotcha.
Right? Because I was trying to get out of Montana. Cause
yeah, it's a nowhere place. If you
nowhere want. Place. When you're in the early 80s, and, you know, it's hard to imagine those times. But, you know, no internet, no connectivity to anywhere. So you physically, you've got to get out of there.
Yeah, exactly. That's how it was for me. I didn't start really doing well until I left my hometown, too.
Right.
And it wasn't necessarily your hometown. It's the same kind of sentiment.
Yeah, well, it's a rite of passage thing almost, too, you know. So.
Yeah.
So I got myself to college in California, right? And so I'm there for a while. And then in Stockton, California, which was another kind of nowhere place, but it was still California. And then my girlfriend came down from Montana, and we were living there together, and she developed an ovarian cyst.
Oh, no.
So we were like, what the hell is this? And we ended up moving to Seattle from California because to get her taken care of, and just, I don't know, I quit school. My dad wouldn't pay anymore or whatever. I quit school. And so by 84, I'm living in Seattle.
Yeah.
And then I start to think about playing guitar again. I'm trying to remember if I... At that point, I actually was acquainted with Bruce Fairweather. He's another obscure rock and roll name who was in Mother Love Bone, as I recall.
Yeah.
Him and Jeff Ament, who had moved also from Montana to Seattle, were sort of these acquaintances in the rock scene. And I got a Rickenbacker, one of those Pete Townsend type ones. I don't remember the name of it. I played that for a little while. I don't think I got in a band. But I also was always into drums. So it's this kind of long story. I played drums a little bit. I played drums in this band. I just have to, you know, I'm replaying the tapes in my brain. So it's like.
I know what you mean. I'm sure it's been a while since you've actually been able to do this.
Yeah. I'm about 85 or so now, 1985, 1986. I took up art. I went to art school then, and so I was a painter, really.
Oh, wow.
As I started like getting back into music and thinking about doing a real band. So I was doing kind of both for a while.
Yeah.
And I played drums in a band called Disappearing, which was an interesting band, super obscure band. The leader of that band was a woman who was in a band called Student Nurse.
Oh, wow.
They had a little bit of a splash in kind of the new wave scene in the 80s. And
yeah, that whole fancy Titan.
The pre-grunge explosion. There was sort of a mini explosion.
Yeah.
It was mostly the U-Men was the big band back then. They were like the hot band.
Yeah, James Bertieshaw said a couple members of the U-Men, when they're on hiatus, are actually in the first lineup of Cat Butt.
Right. I believe it.
The song on the Sub Pop 200 collection was that lineup. I forget which guys exactly were handing back to the tape. But
right.
Yeah.
So I jammed with James Tillman, who was the bass player at one point, thought about doing a band with him, you know. Blah, blah, blah. I befriended Matt Cameron, who's the drummer from Soundgarden at that point.
Yeah.
And he was a fan of my artwork, right? So I made tried to do an album cover for Soundgarden. I sort of lamely tried to try out for bass after their first bass player left.
How'd that work out?
It was more of a, Matt could tell I wasn't that serious. I wasn't a bass player, really. I was just like winging it, thinking, man, if I could get in Soundgarden, that'd be awesome. So he humored me, I think. You know, we sat in his apartment and messed around a little, but it didn't go beyond that. I wasn't ready yet to be a dedicated musician again. So, but all this time, sort of, I'd been practicing guitar. I had guitars, and I get this Ibanez Les Paul copy, which was a great guitar, which is also a guitar I wish I still had.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
It sort of seems like a classic nowadays. You know, it's probably Japanese made and just really well made, sounded good. And so I'm trying to remember exactly if I placed an ad or if Lauren, the singer from Gnome, placed an ad. But, you know, through the ad thing, we got together and started a band in probably 88 or 89.
So Gnome started in way back in around the same time Nirvana was starting.
Yeah, right? Yeah, maybe a little later, because Nirvana was inspirational for me as an artist, I remember.
Well,
you know, I would go to these shows, and I wasn't a musician, so I was just part of the crowd, and there were some great shows, man. That's definitely something I'm happy to have lived through. It was an exciting time.
Yeah, I can imagine. I mean, I was in a band a few years ago, and I loved playing live.
Yeah.
I didn't like the egos that went along with it.
Yeah, right.
So if Gnome started in around 88, 89, was it the same formed on both the albums?
Say that again. I didn't hear your question.
I said, since Gnome started that early,
yeah.
Was it the same lineup?
Yeah, you know, and I think it's a little later, because I was still painting in 89, so I think it's more like 89, 90.
Oh, okay, fair
when
enough.
When we formed, not 88.
This is about 30 years ago now, so I don't
know
for being a little fuzzy.
Well, I have a tattoo I know I got in 89, and it's prior to Gnome, so it's like,
nice.
That's my indicator.
How was the chemistry between you guys? What were your early gigs like and stuff? How well were you received within the scene?
Well, not very well. We stayed obscure, man. It was weird. It was a hard time to be a new band. And we kind of came out of left field for people because, like, we weren't super – I wasn't a super entrenched musician, you know. Like, some of these people had been in band after band and – with each other and other bands, and so, you know, they were part of a larger group, you know, the grunge group. And we weren't really part of that group. and we were sort of an anti-band. you know, we were like, this is, we thought the whole, we just wanted to make good contemporary rock music, you know.
And
we weren't afraid to be melodic. We didn't really have much of an attitude. Like, we had an anti-attitude. We were like an anti-pop band, right? So we didn't quite fit with the, we weren't sarcastic or ironic at all. None of that. And so some of those bands, like the Mudhoneys of the scene, I think were sort of like, didn't get it. They didn't get us because we were trying something else.
I personally, I found you guys via a video on YouTube of your video for On the House.
Yep, the one video.
At that time, and this was like maybe 3 or 4 years ago, so I've actually been a diehard since I found that video. That was the only thing on YouTube available from you guys. I had to buy Six High Surprise Tower secondhand from Germany for like $45.
Really?
Yes. I could not find it for any cheaper. And the weird thing is, for some reason, now I found the record for about $15.
Weird.
Yeah. And your second album's like unable to find.
Right. So you don't have that one.
I do now because you sent it to me.
Oh yeah.
And I appreciate that very much. That made me very happy.
Oh sure.
I mean,
so you can see from the anti-band thing. Like, we posed as these other characters in the fiberglass CD, you know, we're like all acting as though we're someone else. And then we consciously cut our heads off on that EP thing. And we were like, we just wanted to be appreciated for the music and for the energy that we put into it. But so it took, the Posies were the band that kind of adopted us most. And we played a good bit around the Northwest with them. And they were cool guys, and I think they thought of us as being a way to a little more credibility for them in the other scene, kind of.
Gotcha.
You know, because they're they came across as like a quote-unquote pop group, right? Like,
yeah,
not grungy, not hard at all.
Yeah, you guys were an anomaly, because when I reviewed Six High Surprise Tower for the Eclipsed Archives on my webzine, I had a hard time describing your sound, because you guys were pre-Bush, but you had certain elements of melody and stuff that some of those guys used later.
Yeah.
But you also had the raw fuzziness and the raw distorted feedback-filled guitars that, you know, bands of the time had, but you had this unmistakable melody to everything you did, and it's, I don't know what it is about your sound, but it's so unique out of all the other bands. Like,
well, I appreciate that.
Stooges and Cat Butt too kind of had their own vibe, as well as the 64 Spiders.
Mm-hmm.
That I can't place you as sounding like Nirvana or Alice in Chains.
Oh yeah,
you know what I mean? Like,
oh
I
yeah, we weren't like them at all. Yeah, consciously. I mean, my big thing at the time I was playing guitar in Nome was more like a My Bloody Valentine style of guitar.
Yeah, absolutely. I can hear that.
Yeah, I'm trying to make notes and bend and not play chord structures. Yeah, like, I was not a Stooges person at the time. I was more of a, I really liked Urge Overkill at that time. And
phenomenal.
My Bloody Valentine and Dinosaur Jr., of course, and trying to think what else I would listen to. Swerve Driver was a big one for me. And then Lauren, the singer, who was the other kind of melodic person, was Cheap Trick, and like Ozzy was a big one for him, I remember.
Nice. So you definitely had different influences.
Yeah. And we were like buds. I mean, he and I in particular.
Were you buds with, in particular?
With Lauren, the singer.
Okay.
We were the guitar players, you know, and
yeah.
And then Ron and Mike were the other two guys. Mike ended up marrying my sister, the drummer.
Oh, wow.
And he's since passed away, and I think Ron Garcia, the bass player, may have passed away too.
When I reached out to CZ Records, they told me that they sent me your profile, which is how I found you, because I really wanted to talk to somebody from the band, and since you guys were on CZ Records, they mentioned that the drummer had passed away, but he mentioned that he had a falling out with Ron that's personal reasons to him and himself, but I didn't
really.
Yeah.
No shit. Who, Daniel from CZ had a falling out with Lauren? Is that what you said?
No, Ron.
Oh, Ron.
Go back to the message.
Weird.
Yeah, I don't know, but he said it was something personal, but I didn't realize that the bass player had passed, too.
Well, I'm not sure. I kind of think, I heard like a grapevine, through the grapevine that he had passed, but I'm not really sure. So I left Seattle in 94, see?
Yeah.
So anything that went down after that, I have no idea. And I haven't been in touch with Lauren since then, because we broke up then after we got back from a tour.
Was there any bad blood between you guys after you guys split or anything?
Oh, no, not at all. I mean, we were disappointed because he quit, right? When the singer quits, it's like, shit. We just called it. And Millette had married my sister, and it was just like time to do something else. I met a woman on that tour who's now my wife, you know, so.
Nice, congratulations.
It was this weird thing where it just was the end. But there was never any bad blood, yeah.
That's good. So you guys obviously were the odd ones out of the scene.
Yeah.
How were you guys playing before CZ Records picked you up, and how did that work out?
Well, we originally had signed with Sub Pop.
Oh, really?
Right before Nirvana saved their asses, we signed with them. But unbeknownst to us, they were in this financial calamitous financial situation, I guess. So this would be 1990 or so.
That's right before Nirvana left them, too.
Yeah, and it all happened all at once, and we signed with them, and then they didn't do anything. And I remember, I'm trying to remember, I think we could never get a budget to record, and so we felt like we had signed this deal that was keeping us from doing anything. And so I can't remember what we did. We went to Daniel at CZ, and we're just like, you know, can you help us out? And he was into it, so Sub Pop let us go.
Nice.
And Daniel picked us up, and it went from there. And it was fun, man. We did a lot of touring and recording. What's that?
What was it like recording the first record?
It was awesome. I mean, it was all of our dreams come true, you know? Recording a record.
I did that thing with it, too. Like, was it kind of nerve-wracking to be in the studio the first time, or were you guys just tight and excited and gassed?
Oh, yeah. We were just tight and excited. Yeah, it wasn't nerve-wracking at all. It was just liberating for us.
That's awesome. What?
Being creative, you know.
What would you say would be your favorite track on that record?
Funnily enough, I don't know, honestly. I mean, Roadhog is one that's when I've listened to it recently. You can listen to it on YouTube, of all places.
Yeah, finally now. I could only get on the house 4 years ago when I first find you. And after
so now you can see the record is on there. I don't know who that is. Someone posted the songs.
Yeah, there's someone who was posting 64 Spiders stuff, too. And, like, James was beyond himself. Like, what? People remember?
Yeah, it's kind of like that. Roadhog's definitely a good one. Free Toy is a good one. I like the heavy qualities of that one.
Yeah, I really like No Wonder Child, too.
Yep.
That's
a good one.
You guys kind of found a way to have that dirginess and the fuzziness of the grunge, but melodies, but also an atmosphere of, like, almost that psychedelic, blissful kind of thing. You guys had all of that in one, to me.
Yeah, blissful, that's a good one, yeah.
Like, just, you know, I don't know how else to explain it, you know?
Yeah. Well, that's awesome. Atmosphere is something we were going for sure.
And atmosphere matters to me a lot in music.
Yeah.
So that may be why I attached to you guys so quickly.
Interesting. Yeah. We were never like a heavy riff.
No.
In too many riffs. And yeah. Like I say, we weren't sarcastic or ironic, which we really consciously were not trying to be like Mudhoney and Tad and who we thought were just sort of like cynical almost, you know.
So what was the first tour like?
First tour, I don't even remember what the first one was. We would go up and down to California, you know, periodically. But
did
then
you have any good shows or decent turnouts or anything like that?
probably not. I would say no. I mean, you know, I don't know. Not really. I don't remember anything where, I mean, there was the good show here and there, but it was hard work, man. That's all I can say. We were somewhat late to come out of Seattle. You know, like people were already like, Seattle.
Or they're a Nirvana clone.
Yeah, so we would get dismissed.
Because you guys were so good.
I appreciate that. It was tough because we, like I say, we tried really hard. That was our thing, and I think that actually ended up alienating some of the Seattle crowd. Was we were just trying really hard, like we meant it.
But it wasn't like a forced trying. You were just trying to do what you wanted to do. You were trying to be a poser.
No, that's right. You're exactly right. And the grunge thing was definitely a pose. Like the Tad band was definitely sort of a pose. They were doing an act, you know.
Yeah, Tad Doyle even said on many documentaries, it was a situation where like, well, I'm not a lumberjack, but I play one on TV. That's
exactly
how Tad Doyle himself put that. So.
Yeah. That's exactly right.
From Sprouse and Chains on a VH1 special, like, years ago, said that, you know, they were basically put together by a producer or whatever to be, like, grunge Backstreet Boys, which I know is a joke, but they were a hair band before. They were also a bit of a blip because of that.
A bit of a what?
They were a bit of an anomaly or a blip or got sort of dismissed early on because of the fact that they were more part of that poofy poodle hair metal side.
Yeah, they sure were, man. That's how I remembered them. That's when they came, when they first came out, they were that.
Parasite, and he said, this is Alice in Chains? Yeah, it sounds like Skid Row.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, they were unabashedly like that. Whipping the hair and the whole, yeah, it was all about the hair. They had this big hair.
Yeah.
Well, so we were a band that had some short hair and some long hair.
Yeah, exactly.
But touring was always fun. It was an adventure, you know. It was something that was, I don't know, do bands still do that even? Like just get in a van? I don't know.
I'm a big fan of the modern music I listen to is actually within a subgenre that's called doom, stoner metal, stoner rock. It's got grunge elements, but it's more of a back to basics approach to the 70s proto metal. Use analog equipment because it's cheap.
Oh yeah.
Probably the biggest name band in that genre is Electric Wizard. And
Electric Wizard.
1993.
Okay.
They've got no mainstream appeal. Trying to mainstream them is like trying to make a snuff film into a children's film. They sell out the London Astoria because they have a big cult following.
Right.
But, like, I saw the band Pentagram, which started it all back in 71 with this stuff, and they travel on an RV together, they eat together, they do it that way because they're not big famous rock stars 50 years later.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Wow.
And Bobby Liebling, the singer, is a dear friend of mine. I don't know if you know that name or have ever heard of them, but
I don't know. They didn't have a documentary.
They did recently called Last Days Here. It was basically about Bobby's return.
Yeah. I think I watched that. It was fascinating.
He's a dear friend of mine, and he's a big sweetheart.
It was just, I can't remember the story well enough, or if I saw another documentary that was similar. What'd you say the name of it was again?
Last Days Here.
Last Days Here.
And Days as in Dazed and Confused, I believe.
Okay. Was he from Pennsylvania?
He's from Germantown, Maryland.
Okay.
Yeah. He's been best friends with Scott Wino Leinrich since 1976 from The Obsessed and St. Vitus.
Okay.
Yeah, those types of bands is what I listen to as far as anything new.
I gotcha.
Yeah.
Which is old. It's old, but it's new, I guess. Eh?
Yeah, because it's not anything that's ever been accepted by the mainstream at
right.
all. And that gives them a certain amount of freedom that most bands don't have these days on the radio.
Yeah.
But, no, they still do that. Like, Bobby and his band were traveling in a tour bus. Fans came out after and got signatures. I got to meet him beforehand and everything because I had interviewed him. But,
mm-hmm.
yeah, it's still down on that level. You just got to look harder for that kind of stuff these days
right.
than just what's thrown at you.
Yeah, so people do still book their own tours and...
Yeah, they literally were traveling on an RV owned by the bass player.
Right.
You know what I mean? So it's very DIY, which, you know, me and
That's
you
cool.
both have similar musical interests here, so we both have that ethic as well and respect that a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that's what it was all about. I mean, we drove across the country at least 3 times on these big-ass tours.
Did you ever open for anybody worth a shit?
Oh, yeah, we opened, we played with almost anybody you can name at the time. We played with Beck in L.A., I remember.
Awesome, okay.
And we hated Beck because he was fucking a guy with a little boombox, and we thought he was a joke.
Yeah.
Because he didn't seem, he has grown on me immeasurably since then, but at the time, because his thing was Loser, right? And the Sub Pop had a shirt that said Loser, and that was their, we thought of it as a branding thing for Sub Pop, and here was this kid in L.A. calling a song Loser, and we were just like, fuck you, man, that's...
Yeah.
Can you be any more obvious? And so,
yeah,
anyway,
yeah.
So, like, we played with Beck, and we played with Stone Temple Pilots before they were huge.
Nice.
Soundgarden, I mean, anybody...
Did you ever win over those crowds at all, though?
I think we always had some curious people in the audience, but it never made our records sell. Or...
That's unfortunate.
We always got places to stay.
That's good. Yeah. I mean,
you know?
I'm not trying to say, did you guys ever, like, open for anybody worth a shit in a negative way? It's just you were dismissed. I was just curious if you were given the same opportunities as everyone else.
Well, yeah, I guess so. You know, if that's what it is, we played the big festivals. We played South by Southwest a couple times. We played the New Music Seminar and CMJ probably a couple times.
Yeah.
And we almost signed with Columbia Records, which was our big, like,
yeah,
thing we almost got. And that was from playing CMJ, as I recall.
Nice.
We ended up doing a demo with them, but the A&R guy just didn't have enough power to kind of sell us to his boss.
Gotcha.
So that was really disappointing.
Yeah, I mean, shit. Hey, I really want to sign you guys, but I can't.
Yeah, I can't. He took us out to dinner. You know, we had the whole wining and dining in L.A. thing. It was so much fun, and we were like, all right, we're going to do it, and he just couldn't make it happen.
Yeah.
So, we had the opportunities, but as we've already discovered here in our conversation, I think we just didn't fit. We weren't enough like Nirvana where they could see the instant accessibility, if you know what I mean. So.
Yeah.
So,
but it's weird because you guys were melodic and stuff enough where, you know, in some sense, you were as melodic, if not more so, than Nirvana was in a way.
Right, but we didn't have the teenage angst thing.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
That's what we didn't have. So that was it. But you know what was always a puzzle to us was why would a band like Candlebox get signed?
Oh, yeah.
They were like totally the antithesis of everything that we thought was good about rock music, and somehow they became a big band, and Bush became a big band, and
that whole post-grunge movement.
Yes, the post-grunge
crap, like that stuff may not have been great, but what came after with Nickelback and Puddle of Mud was even
Puddle of Mud.
My ex thought they were so great, but could not understand why I hated them. I said, because you're taking a genre that was very asexual in a way, very non-misogynistic, to singing with that grunge Jarl and singing about fucking some chick. It doesn't fit. Am I right?
You're right. And plus, their name was Puddle of Mud. Come on.
Even Puddle of Shit. That's a try to be like, yeah, Puddle of Mud, that sounds grungy. Well, we
right,
see
so I guess that was an easy sell in the A&R department of whatever label, right? Cause it was,
and then that led to nu metal, which was even worse.
Yeah. Was that the stuff with, like, Limp Bizkit and that stuff?
Yeah, Slipknot, Korn, Limp Bizkit.
Oh, hated that stuff.
I did, too. I liked Slipknot when I was a self-hating 12-year-old, but then a few years later, I tried to listen to it. I'm like, this is fucking shit.
Yeah, isn't that interesting to do nowadays, is listen to what you liked then, or what seems to hold up, or my favorite thing is what I didn't like at the time. Like, I hated Stone Temple Pilots more than anything, but their music and Scott Weiland as a singer have really, for me anyways, kind of stood the test of time.
Yeah,
and I'm surprised that I there was a time when I never would have said that, but I can freely say that today.
Gary Conner said the same thing about it, because he said their first record, like, one song sounded like Nirvana, one song sounded like IC, but then their next record, they were more, he was like, oh, they have more.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
they're just really talented and good with melody.
Yeah, exactly. And
so for me, it's always about melody and songs.
Melody, songs, and atmosphere.
Yeah.
Most.
Led Zeppelin's my number one band of all time, in case you're wondering about that.
Oh, yeah, I was. And it's funny, as I look down at the four symbols on the fourth album, I have tattooed on my wrist. Like, yeah.
They're like, if I had to pick one band, I would pick them.
Nice. So when it came time to do the second record.
Yeah.
Obviously, the second record shows a bit more progression.
More production values, for sure.
Yeah. Was that a conscious decision on you guys, or did that just kind of happen after playing for a while and making the first record and just generally getting, I don't want to say better, not that you were bad, but you know what I mean.
Well, yeah, it was more of a general progression, and we had attracted John Auer from the Posies as a producer, and so we were working with someone now who was sort of able to make suggestions and say, hey, why don't you do an acoustic on this track, and why don't you, you know, whatever the suggestion was. And so he was definitely involved in the production aspects of it and making it sound different than just us in the room, which is what the first record was more like.
Which they both have, you know, I like both records almost equally, but for different reasons.
Yeah.
One of the things I like about the first is that just raw, you know, hungry set up and play live, really.
That's how we were, yeah.
So then, how was that tour, and how did you guys disband? What all really happened? Because this is all history that's really not known, at least in the public.
Well, the last tour was this big epic tour, which was all across the entire country. We went down to California first, and then over, as I remember, and up the East Coast, and kind of back down, and in support of that record. And it was one of those tours where we would show up at the record store and they wouldn't have the record, kind of thing.
Oh, wow, that's awful.
You know, and we're like, fuck, what the fuck are we going to do? We don't have anything to promote. And, you know, so we'd play all these venues and shows, and it was disappointing and frustrating and tough on us. And
well, I'm sure your finances and everything weren't very good either.
I don't even remember how we did that, to be honest with you. You know, I don't even remember. I don't remember how we got money or,
yeah,
you know, because I think CZ supported us on some level. We had a publishing deal that we had done, actually.
Gotcha.
With a company called Feedback, which was associated with Burt Bacharach.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
And he had a partner that had a publishing company, and we had signed a deal with them that got us like $40,000, which we split up and each had like $10,000. And I'm thinking that we've kind of all lived off of that.
Yeah.
As we toured this final tour. But I met my wife on that tour in Pennsylvania, which was the momentous thing for me. I meet this woman and kind of fall in love with her. And so we're playing these gigs in the South. And in Chicago, we play this gig. I'm trying to remember. We finally get to Chicago, and I can't remember if the gig was something was – there was no – there was like – we had at least one gig when there were zero people, and we just were like, we're not even going to play. It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
In Memphis, Tennessee, as I remember. But anyway, so we get to the kind of – we're starting to head back home, and we just quit in Chicago. We just quit the tour and just drove straight all the way back home just without stopping.
Wow.
And so we get back home, and I think we might have played one or two gigs back in Seattle, and then Lauren just quit. Like, there was no – he just had it. That's how I remember it.
Well, you got so far, but yet you didn't at the same time, and I can understand the frustration of something's not working, you know.
Yeah, but and, you know, we didn't – I didn't really feel it. As a member of the band, I felt like, okay, let's, you know, keep going. I've got some good ideas for songs, and, you know, I still love playing guitar, and I was ready to keep going. And we were on our – we had – Millette, the original drummer, had quit prior to this tour, and so
okay.
We had this new guy, Jeff, who was a great drummer. But I think maybe that was part of this instability that Lauren felt. I don't know. He was cool. Jeff was cool. But
yeah, because I was going to ask, because I was waiting for, but he had an ego problem or something, but he was cool. So it makes me wonder why, you know, there were so many bands in the scene that shuffled through many different members and still stayed together. So losing a drummer once doesn't seem like Spinal Tap or instability to me.
No, it wasn't. Lauren just was, he was just tired of it, and we weren't going to replace him as a singer and a creative partner for me.
You really couldn't.
No.
He had a uniqueness to it, you know?
Yep. He had great lyrics, interesting lyrics, often about Jesus and faith and stuff, and like...
On the house, as Jesus is alive, playing...
Yeah, exactly. If Jesus was alive, I'm sure he'd take the blame.
Yeah, exactly. That's a...
he did stuff, though, that was annoying, too. Like, he would go into gigs and not know any of the lyrics and just mouth these syllables. And I think some people were savvy enough, and they would bust him on it and call him out on that.
So what did you do after the band... broke up, dissipated? I don't know what word to use.
Yeah,
there.
We broke up, whatever. Yeah, I tried to get in a band called Silkworm.
I've heard of it.
Which was another obscure late Seattle rock band, but I was friends with them, and they had lost the guitar player, and I was like, I would love to be in that band. Why don't you let me? But
yeah.
They went on as a three-piece. I was briefly in a band called Pretty Mary Sunshine, which is a super obscure band. I don't remember if they did a record. You got to look them up.
I will.
But I was not quite fit for their – the leader's main thing was like the Beach Boys crossed with Seattle and more of a – even more of a atmospheric feel – than I was into doing at that time, so I didn't fit in with them really. I think we played one kind of house party, and then I bailed on that. And then my wife and I left town because she had moved to Seattle, believe it or not, from Pennsylvania.
Oh, wow.
We got married in Las Vegas.
Nice.
Super fast. We knew each other for 6 months, and we were already married and, you know, ready to go. And so she and I just got out of there. She didn't really like Seattle at the time. It wasn't very welcoming for her.
Yeah.
And we tried living in Montana for a little bit.
That sounds easy.
Where some of my family was still. And so 1994, 5.
Gotcha.
And then we moved back east to Pennsylvania, and I've lived there until 2015.
Where are you at now?
What's that?
Where are you at now?
I live in Bainbridge Island, Washington, which is an island off the coast of Seattle, essentially.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, it's pretty nice.
So what have you been doing in the meantime? I mean, do you
still
have itch to play?
I became a fine art appraiser.
Wow, that's impressive.
So that's my thing is art these days, and trying to make a living off of that.
Gotcha.
And she and I in Pennsylvania ran a kind of art gallery hair salon for 15 years.
Nice. So, that's an interesting combination. That sounds odd, but that sounds really freaking cool.
Yeah, it was cool. We were like the gnome of hair salons, you know. We didn't really fit in, and we were against the system, essentially. Like, we didn't want to have mirrors, and we wanted it always to be about the relationship between the hairstylist and the client, you know, so that it was all just about people and inspiration and aesthetics. And
gotcha.
So we did that for a long time, and we were able to sell it, you know, and make money, and we moved out here because my family all migrated to the Seattle area from Montana.
Okay, so
right?
You wanted
so,
to be your family.
Yeah, so my mom and my brother and sister, two sisters, all live in the area here, so we kind of came back, and we have two older kids, and they were in high school here, so that's what's going on.
Do you ever get the itch to play in a band again at this point in your life? Or at
well,
least...
I mean, I don't know how to, I don't know. It's like if someone said, hey, I've got this perfect opportunity, I would say sure.
Well, I have a perfect opportunity, but I'm getting a computer with recording software and an interface at some point, and I play guitar and I like your band. I'd be willing to make a record with you. If...
Oh, crazy. I would never have thought of that. I don't know that I would do that. I don't know, man. I mean, I sit around and I play acoustic guitar right now, and that's what I do. I just kind of play scales and...
Well, it'd just be you and me. I have a friend back home in York, PA, who is an amazing musician. I'll have to send you some of my demos that she worked on for me.
You should.
I, you know, it would just be something small, you and me, nothing me, but it's up to you. I just want to throw that offer out there.
I appreciate that. It's flattering.
Because, I mean, you know, I always am the kind of person and the kind of fan where, and it's probably because of my Asperger's, but when I like something, I find every inch, nook, and cranny of it. So, you know, and
yeah, I get that.
People, your band that are grunge fans that never heard you guys that are young bands playing that style of music, like
yeah.
And I think they're somewhere in the Midwest there, if I recall. I'm sorry, Johnny, if I'm not, but
who's in the Midwest?
A band called Siddhartha. They're a young two-piece. They don't have...
Siddhartha, huh.
Yeah, they have a drummer named Manny that's a mannequin that they dress up in photo shoots just to take the piss out of it because they can't find a steady drummer, so live they use a drum machine.
That's pretty funny.
Yeah. But I showed him your stuff because he's into Pond and all those other, all the bands, you know, obscure or not. But he had never heard you guys. And
yeah.
He was impressed. He was like, impressed. It was like, oh, my God, they're so good. Why didn't I hear about them before?
Yeah.
So, you know, there's still an interest for that style of music, obviously, if a young band out in the Midwest is playing that kind of style.
Yeah, yeah.
So.
Hey, you never know. You can send me whatever you want, and I'll just tell you what I can or cannot do.
Oh, okay. No problem.
Like I say, I don't really, I just play acoustic guitar, and I don't have an electric guitar. I haven't played an electric guitar in a long time, and I'm not like a pro musician by any means.
Neither am I. I'm self-taught.
Yeah.
You showed me 3 chords and the power chord, and I went off. And somewhere between, like, I've got, like, a punky, I'm a very rock and roll style guitar player with metal overtones, but not straight up metal. You know,
yeah.
What I mean? I can, like, play, like, shredding solos and stuff, but, like, my rhythms are very punky and more, if you could mix, like, punk rock and Kiss, that's what a lot of my stuff sounds like. No, and I was always into the New York Dolls and, you know, my pen name, Andy Thunders. I mean, but, you know, it's funny because nobody really wants to play, like, music like that anymore. It's all got to be, like, heavy metal, which is so limiting. Whereas if you're a rock band, you can paint with different colors. You know what I
mean? Yeah. That doesn't exist anymore, really?
Not really in the mainstream, no. There's a band out of Portsmouth, England that I've been following for a long time that started off as a mock hair band but became the Smokin' Prophets.
Hmm.
With, he's into Syd Barrett, Johnny Thunders, T-Rex, and they're so good. They're high-energy, basic rock with a nice, pissed-off, raspy voice that's not grungy, though.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but like I said, they're a very do-it-yourself independent band that's been playing clubs and stuff over there for the better half of the last decade that I've been doing this, because he was one of the first people I met, the singer and guitarist Marty, who writes most of the stuff. People have described them as somewhere between the Ramones and Guns N' Roses.
That's interesting.
Yeah. So other than that, there's not much real quote-unquote rock and roll. You're either punk, you're metal, you're this, you're that.
Yeah.
You know, so. Well, to wrap up here, what do you love about music and what do you love about art?
Oh, man. I don't know. How do you describe it? It's just, I don't know. It's been with me my whole life and it's part of my everyday life, music. But I don't know how to tell you what it is. It's strange. I like some of the memories that it provides me. I like the continuity that it creates, you know, for life, the soundtrack of our lives, you know. That's actually a big part of it, is like context.
Yeah.
I guess.
Nice.
I don't know how to describe it. I like playing guitar because it's something I can just sit and do. I'm like a doer. I like to do.
Me
so
too.
Sitting and playing guitar. It's like, yeah, I would, when I was a teenager, it's practice guitar and play guitar. And
that's,
you just do it by yourself. You don't need anybody else.
Yeah. I learned how to play. My first records I started playing was Let There Be Rock by AC/DC. Never Mind the Bollocks, Here's the Sex Pistols, and Pink Floyd's Piper at the Gates of Dawn. The first 3 records I was learning the whole way through on bass.
Wow, so you would just let the record play and just play along?
Yeah, that's what I would do. I read tabs for bass because I could actually read them, but when I try to look at a guitar tab, it's like reading Chinese.
Yeah, too many little dots and stuff.
Yeah, and it's like, but what I do, if I want to learn a song, I actually can watch someone on YouTube playing along to it and pick it up.
Yeah. Yeah, I figured that out too. I love doing that, actually.
I 3 or 4 Misfits songs in an hour one time. And my ex's sister was so impressed. I'm like, I'm really not that great.
Yeah, it's called YouTube. You should check it out.
But, like, you know, I always tell people, and maybe it's the self-degrading artist thing, but, you know, I have extreme limitations as a guitar player, but I also use those limitations to my advantage.
Oh, that's the secret. Yeah.
Exactly.
That's what makes you you.
Is there anything else that you would like to say to your fans, your followers of either your band or your art, anything?
No. Keep going. Keep at it. Don't
what
ever give up.
Give any young artists today?
Like bands?
Bands, artists, painters, whatever.
Can I think of any? Is that what you're asking me?
Yeah, like what advice would you give to young artists?
Oh, gotcha.
Yeah.
Man, I don't know. Do it because you love to do it.
That's awesome.
Music, for sure. And I would say for art, I'm an art critic more than anything. I would say...
And I'm a music critic. Go figure.
Yeah, so for art, I would say make sure you're trying to say something. Make sure that you're trying to show people something they can understand.
Or something they can relate to.
Something they can get, because so much of art is just total bullshit.
Yeah, like Apple sitting there on display.
emptiness, just people. I mean, I think the death of art happened when abstract expressionism happened, and Jackson Pollock just threw paint at the canvas.
Yeah.
And created his, you know, they're iconic to most people now, these drip paintings, but... For me, that's like total anti-art because it has no meaning that you can see.
I absolutely understand and agree with where you're coming from.
Well, it's good talking to you, Andy. I appreciate it.
Yeah, it was good talking to you too, man. I really enjoyed this. I hope you keep in contact, and I'll get this up in a couple of days for you, man. It was an absolute honor.
I'm curious to check it out.
All right.
All right, I'll get in touch.
All right, take care, man.
Okay, bye.